We'll call the meeting of the Tourism Infrastructure and Energy to order. Ms. Kimberly, please call the roll.
Chair Drake.
Yes.
Vice Chair Lamarcus.
Yes, ma'am.
Ranking Democratic Member Schlossberg. Representatives Brown. Here. Buchanan.
Here.
Cheney. Davis. Fine.
Here.
Joseph.
Here.
McFarland.
Here.
Roth.
Here.
Schoaf.
Here.
Silvers. He is excused. Skidmore.
Here.
Toledo.
Here.
Trabosley.
Here.
Williamson.
Here.
Yarborough.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Ms. Young. Members of the audience, if you would, please silence your phones or other electronic devices. Welcome back, members. It's great to have almost everyone back for the 2022 session, including our Vice Chair, Rep. Lamarcus, and Ranking Member, Representative Schlossberg. We also want to welcome one new committee member, a representative from Tampa, Representative Jackie Toledo. Welcome to our committee, Representative Toledo. We also have one new member on our staff, Ms. Lydia Walsh, who recently joined us as a policy analyst. So, Ms. Walsh, we appreciate your service and welcome to our team. On a more somber note, we lost a member of our staff this past summer. Ms. Amanda Regas, our administrative assistant, passed away earlier this month. She was a valuable member of our team here, and we will miss her tremendously. So if we would, keep Amanda's family and friends in your thoughts and prayers. And if I could, I'd like to ask Representative Yarborough if he would lift the family up in a moment of prayer.
Happy to do that, Mr. Chairman, if you'll join me in prayer. Father, thank you for this day that you have made. And we lift Amanda and her family and the House family up to you and ask that you would comfort them at this time. And we thank you for Amanda's service to the House and to the people of Florida and to us and this institution. And again, we just ask for your comfort. We pray that you administer to her family. And we just thank you again for her and what she meant, and pray that you would help us to honor you in all that we say and do. Thank you, Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.
Amen. Thank you, Representative Yarborough. Members, committee, on Monday, Governor Ron DeSantis issued a proclamation that this week is Clean Energy Week in Florida. Appropriately, our agenda includes a discussion of electric vehicles issues. In 2020, we passed legislation that required the Department of Transportation to coordinate, develop, and recommend a master plan for current and future plans for the development of electric vehicle charging station infrastructure along the state highway system. That master plan was just recently released. DOT was the agency with primary responsibility for the plan, and the Public Service Commission was required to address certain goals and objectives in the plan. We have speakers here today from both agencies to address the plan. First, we have invited Mr. Brad Thoburn, Assistant Secretary at DOT. Mr. Thoburn, when you're ready, you're recognized.
Okay, there we go. Thank you, Chairman. Appreciate the opportunity to present on the electric vehicle infrastructure master plan today. As you noted, the plan is available. You should have received a copy, a hard copy, and it's available online, as well as related information on the website. As you also noted, the department and others were required to develop and recommend a master plan for electric vehicle charging station infrastructure along the state highway system. We did this working with Florida Public Service Commission, Florida DEP, as well as several other agencies. Our charge specifically was to identify future EV charging stations and locations, identify barriers to adoption of electric vehicles, quantify revenue impacts associated with the adoption of electric vehicles, and also identify implementation strategies that would advance the implementation of electric vehicles, especially along the state highway system. So with that, we actually used a very collaborative process to develop the plan. We coordinated with several agencies, conducted extensive outreach, And obviously, the PSC was a major partner in developing this, and you'll hear from Casey after me. But they were essential in providing that utility perspective, which is a key piece of this conversation. So they not only provided the regulatory information, but they actually wrote the utility chapter to the EVMP. Other agencies shared their initiatives and lessons learned, and which helped inform the plan. And ultimately, we worked with over 150 different stakeholders as part of our outreach process. We had three key objectives that emerged from the effort. One was to support short and long-range electric vehicle travel, as well as emergency evacuation, which is extremely important to consider. We also looked at how we can adapt state highway infrastructure in a manner that's consistent with market demand. And lastly, we wanted to ensure availability of adequate and reliability EV charging stations. So as of EV infrastructure, first I wanted to kind of give you just a snapshot of what's out there today and sort of the world of EVs. Sometimes you'll hear it referred to as EVSE, which is electric vehicle supply equipment. Essentially, it's all equipment related to charging stations for EVs, but you may hear different terminology along the way. The technology piece is obviously very important in this discussion. It really is a key part of the barriers to adoption of electric vehicles. And simply put, you know, people simply can't, people just can't wait hours to charge a vehicle, especially when they're traveling longer distances. So there are three types of charging infrastructure you can see here. Level one is kind of the basic, you can charge, plug in at home. Level two, which is really the dominant technology right now, and is available for largely commercial purposes, but you can install at home as well. And that really takes about 2 hours to charge, so it's a lot more effective than the level one, which takes up to 8 or more hours to charge. And then the latest technology, or the plug-in technology that's really the focus of our effort, is the direct current fast charging stations, which can charge within 30 minutes. We wanted to note also that, you know, we're in the world of rapidly emerging technology, new mobility solutions, and one of the things we're seeing out there is the growth in research and development of wireless power transfer, which is an inductive form of charging. And so it's kind of an intriguing thing. We're going to be watching it to see how it develops and how we can actually potentially utilize that. So I think as we go forward, you're going to see some more conversations about that, maybe some testing opportunities. We certainly think that things like our managed lane infrastructure, the SunTrax facility in Central Florida, offer unique opportunities for us to maybe test some of these technologies. So as it relates to the location and availability of the EVSE infrastructure, this is obviously a critical concern. You hear about range anxiety, people concerned that they're going to be left out on the highway without a charge and a place to get a charge. So the map on the left shows existing publicly available EVSE stations in the state. Now you'll notice most of them are using level two technology. We conducted a gap analysis to determine where the charging stations needed to be located. We considered a number of different factors. The primary factors were where we had a lack of existing EVSE coverage, simply just don't have the infrastructure or the charging stations in place. We also looked at traffic volume and proximity to interchanges, because we know those are locations where people are most likely to stop. And then another key factor was evacuation routes, because we know that, that will be a critical concern in the event of an evacuation. We did provide that link on here, is actually a story map that you can access that kind of walks you through and shows in a more interactive way the mapping of the existing infrastructure. So we also looked at the adoption of EVs and really tied that also then beyond that into the revenue impacts. So currently, Florida's EV adoption rate is about 0.41% based on the motor vehicle registration data that we have. Some of the barriers I mentioned are anxiety. Another is the cost of the infrastructure, the parity between the EVs and internal combustion engines. There's also the lack of charging infrastructure and the charging times. However, the industry itself is making tremendous growth in adoption, and we expect that over the next decade. So we looked at three different projections using market current market trends and market analysis to project out a low, medium, and high rate of adoption. And as you can see, in 2040, EV ownership could be as high as 35% in the state. And so that's the high end of it. And we also see, the automotive industry is setting some pretty aggressive targets about EVs. You can see with Volvo, Ford, and GM. GM specifically has pledged that all their light-duty cars and SUVs will be EVs by 2035. So now those are their goals. So obviously we wait to see how that transpires, but you can see the industry is making a move towards electric vehicles. As it relates to funding impacts, we obviously motor fuel consumption-based revenue streams are going to be impacted in a negative way by the increase in electric vehicles on the market. And that relates to both national, state, regional, and local levels. So it's not just a state issue. Obviously, it's a broader issue. We show the funding impacts here based on revenue projections from the December REC. And we estimate the impacts of reduced gasoline and diesel fuel consumption on both the highway fuels tax, the state SETS fuel tax, as well as local option distribution. The revenue impacts could range anywhere from 5.6% to 20% by the year 2040, depending on which adoption scenario actually comes to be reality. And the this represents cumulative revenue impacts of up to 7% under the aggressive scenario specifically. Sorry. When factoring all transportation revenue streams, a 1% increase in EV market adoption translates into about a 0.5 or 0.5% reduction in the state transportation trust fund when you kind of contemplate the amount of revenues impacted in total. So the statute also asked us to look at what other states are doing to address the revenue issue and the sort of this transition to electric vehicles. A number of them have implemented registration fees, or they've got various pilots that are sometimes funded by the federal government as pilot initiatives. And then there's all other states that have adopted zero emission vehicle regulations that specifically require automakers to sell a certain percentage of electric vehicles. We're obviously, and if you look in the report, you can see a little more detail on those. Obviously, we're happy to provide information about things we see in other states. It's something we always track and watch and make sure that we have a good sense of what's happening and doing, the lessons learned and best practices from our partners. So this takes us to the point where we move towards recommendations and really kind of assessing what is our role in the EV adoption space. And we identified four areas. They are to adapt, facilitate, educate, and coordinate. As it relates to adapting, this is intended for the DOT to lead. It is the intent of DOT to lead the adaption of existing infrastructure itself to support the move towards electrified mobility. And this may include really our work to anticipate and monitor market and industry trends that will help inform our decision making about infrastructure. And we also will be looking at research and testing of next generation EVSEs. And that may be like the wireless power transfer or inductive charging referenced earlier, or high duty EVSC. And also, you know, we have this opportunity to leverage some of our existing infrastructure to test some of these things. And then we're going to look for opportunities to expand the EVSC network along our infrastructure, fill the gaps, develop and implement a phased approach for EVSC deployment, and include EVSC in the planning and project development and deployment of mobile charging and actually deploy a mobile charging program to support evacuation specifically, which we think is critical. So the next item is to facilitate, and this has the department serving in a role between public and private partners to strategically enhance EV infrastructure. Obviously, there are a lot of partners in the EV world, and we're just one of many. And so our role there can be to identify and pursue a variety of funding opportunities that may become available, especially with federal funding. And as we anticipate the potential for that, we will be looking for partnership opportunities. And then we look at promoting EVSC infrastructure to support long-range corridor travel and emergency evacuation. The next item is to educate, and this is centered on public awareness of electric transportation infrastructure and how it affects electric mobility. And as you may know, a lot of the challenges with and the barriers are related to just perceptions about electric vehicles. So it's important that we provide a awareness of what electric vehicle charging stations are, maybe through our Florida 511 app, websites, social media, et cetera. And we can work with local agencies in terms of providing technical guidance and support. And then specifically, there are opportunities to work with fleets for education and outreach programs. The last item is the coordination. And FDOT is looking to coordinate with all stakeholders and to continue the work of the stakeholder group. Really specifically focused on short-range and long-range EV travel options. The examples could be working with other states in the Southeast to harmonize our interstate corridor electrification efforts and continuing to work with the EVSE stakeholder group. Obviously, as I mentioned before, we continue to monitor and look for lessons learned from other states and other partners and how they can be applied. And that includes not only the states, but utilities and other pilots that are out there. I know that Casey's going to talk probably a little bit about some of the pilots he's seen in the utility side. So with that, again, you can download the final report from our website. The department is continuing to work with our various partners as we look to adapt to the changing world of mobility. So we're obviously seeing a lot of emerging mobility or emerging technology, and it's always on the front of our mind thinking, how do we adapt and change and take advantage of those opportunities? And as the secretary likes to say, we are working to prepare for the end of the ice age, which is the internal combustion engines. So with that, I'm available for any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Thoburn. Members of the committee, do we have any questions? Our representative from the Florida Department of Transportation. Representative from West Palm Beach, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Thoburn. Being a native of the state of Florida, I'm very excited about the idea of electric vehicles in the state of Florida. One of the advantages we obviously have is batteries are more efficient in warmer temperatures. So I think electric vehicles, simpler, lighter weight, smaller engines, less moving parts. There's just a lot of really good reasons we should be going in this direction. One of the negatives, which you kind of inferred, is we're losing transportation dollars. So we hate to think about we're going to tax electricity for cars. But is there any thought being given to that an electric charging station, you could charge a 5% tax and somehow or another figure out how the state of Florida would get that revenue from a charging station? How are we going to fund that?
Yeah, obviously that's a matter for discussion and would require legislative action. We do offer to provide any information and lessons learned from our partners. We do, we see a lot of pilots, and there are a number of states. I think there's more than 20 states that actually have implemented a electric vehicle charge. Sometimes you can do it. There's different mechanisms they use. Sometimes it's a vehicle registration fee. Sometimes it's point of sale. You know, it's there's different approaches to that. And so what we're doing is monitoring those. We also know that this is a conversation that probably requires more of a global solution, and that it requires us to work with our partner states and also have more of a federal perspective, because it's impacting everybody. And it's, you know, it's like, I think, as you know, I mean, the people who are coming into Florida or driving in Florida aren't all originating in Florida. So our solution has to be coordinated with our partners.
Mentioning our partner states, so is there a more dominant approach? Is there something that you're seeing that's taking place in some of the other states?
I don't know that I would say there's a dominant. There's really just a broad perspective, a broad range of different approaches, and I don't know that anyone has kind of emerged as the preferred one. As I mentioned, there's 20 states that have electric vehicle, some form of electric vehicle charge. It's probably the most dominant, you know, if you'd see. But there are a lot of other experiments out there. And I know, like, Virginia's got a program, and they passed legislation that's really not just geared towards EVs, but it's about, you know, the declining revenues associated with more fuel-efficient vehicles.
If there are 20 states that are now providing that type of infrastructure, where do we rank? Are we probably the one that has the most interest?
Oh, I don't know how I would rank it. I'm not sure.
Being offered, is Florida, are there more people that are interested in electric vehicles? Or is the usage
in terms
data
of the adoption,
showing?
Yeah, I mean, I think, 1.9 is the national. We're at 0.41. So, but there's a couple states like California that really skew it. So we can give you that whole list of where the states are and where we
it was just general. General knowledge, no homework assignment. You had mentioned some of the infrastructure gaps. Where are you seeing those in Florida?
Well, they tend to be in areas, it's a market-driven issue, so it's where, you know, you would have areas where the travel's less and the cost of putting the infrastructure is higher, and they're not going to generate as much demand. So they tend to be among more rural areas. You tend to see the urban areas have a lot more infrastructure, and you can look at that map, and it's pretty telling. I mean, it's pretty good on the interstates, but you can also see there's some real gaps in some of the more rural areas.
Representative from Brevard County.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is an issue of great personal interest to me, since before I even got elected to the legislature, I bought an electric vehicle, and that is what I use to get here. So I would like to look at the map with you and sort of point out the good places along the way between here and Tallahassee, make some suggestions. By the way, when I first got elected, there were three places I could charge between my home and Tallahassee, and now there are five. So it has sort of, and those are Tesla supercharger stations. So the infrastructure has grown. But I have two things I wanted to ask about. The first is, I think it's great that you're looking at locations to put, we'll call fast charge stations. But I'd ask, have you thought as well about the number of spaces at those stations? Because I will tell you, over time, the supercharging location that had six spaces 6 years ago, and I could pull up and there's no problem, you know, now you pull up and there's five cars waiting. So are you not only thinking about where you put them, but how many devices there will be at each of those stations? I think that's an important consideration.
It really is, and it's really important when we talk about the emergency evacuation. Mm-hmm. You know, because they'll be over. So we're going to look at that. We're going to look at mobile stations that we could maybe bring out during the an evacuation scenario. So yeah, but you're right. It's not just about the distance between them. And if you look at sort of the plan for moving forward. It's about not only shrinking the gap in those areas, but then increasing the number of stations available. And so there is a if you look in the document, it does talk about kind of that transition to a more robust network.
One more question, if it's okay, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Switching topics, I'm always troubled by analyses like here or that my good friend Representative Roth brought up, that the notion of we have to tax EV drivers because they're EV driving. And so I have a question of when I got one of these cars and I charge it at my house, I get an electric bill, and somehow the taxes I pay on that electric bill seem to have gone up after I started plugging my car in. There actually are taxes on your electric bill. So have you modeled, because whether it comes in at the gas station or it comes in when I pay my electric bill, if I'm consuming power, I'm paying taxes on that. Have you done any analysis to look at what the offsetting revenue increase would be when my electric bill at home goes up $100 or $200 or $300 a month, because that's where I'm charging my car? And I'm assuming the same is true when Tesla is buying the power at the supercharger in Gainesville. They're probably paying taxes as well. That would be incremental tax revenue. Have we thought about that as well?
So that's incremental tax revenue that's not dedicated for transportation, but you're right. It does.
It could be.
I think that's part of the conversation. I think if you're talking about an EV charge that's charged by essentially the outlet, then that's part of the conversation you'd have. Yeah.
Okay.
But I don't know. I don't know that we looked at like the incremental of, you know, other taxes that are going up. So that's a good question.
I guess with one last follow up, Mr. Chairman, that's okay.
We're here till we got 30 more minutes.
Oh, all right.
As time as you need.
I just would ask that you think about that, and maybe next time you do this chart, think about how much incremental revenue is coming in so we can see what we might be able to use to offset those losses, because there are incremental taxes being paid. Thank you.
Understood. Thanks.
We're in no hurry, no rush. Democratic ranking member from Boca Raton, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. Going off of what Representative Fine was just mentioning, do we know what the average amount of fuel tax that we collect per vehicle is annually? And are we looking at ways of offsetting that amount, not just by registration fees, but also by mileage or road tax use?
I don't know. I don't have the number with me. We can get you the number of the average. I know we do have that. But again, those are all items that we're looking at. There's just a sort of a continuum of different approaches that are coming out. One of the things that we've just, you know, I think people are looking to do pilots here. And if you look around, there's, I think, a total of 7 federally sponsored pilots. There's going to be more. And so they're all kind of exploring those different options of replacement for lost revenues. And there's some states that are actually, you know, whether it's Utah and Oregon are kind of up front on that. I mentioned Virginia's got a new legislation in that regard. So, again, we're going to be following all of those, but we can provide you that information.
Additional question, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. My next question, do you know which states have adopted 177 of the Clean Air Act to require automakers to sell certain proportion of their vehicles as zero emission vehicles?
Yeah, in fact, I'm not sure what page. It's actually, you can see in the report, we do have a map that shows the states that have actually adopted that ZEV mandate. I'm not sure. We'll get you the reference for that. But we do have we actually have a list of all those states.
And my last question is, are there any financial incentives offered at the state or local levels to encourage consumers to purchase electric vehicles that you know of?
There are federal tax credits, but then there are a variety of pilots that have happened with some of the utilities that I think Casey may touch on too, where where it may not be, and it's not always geared necessarily towards the purchase of electric vehicles. It may be to deploy the electric vehicle charging stations.
There's probably a personal incentive because the cost of electricity is cheaper than the cost of petroleum. Correct?
Excuse me?
I was responding to the representative from Boca Raton that there may be a personal incentive that the cost of electricity is cheaper than the cost of petroleum without the government providing an additional incentive there. Who else? We have Representative from McCoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know earlier you kind of mentioned sort of partnerships, and we've been talking about other states and resources, but what I wanted to find out is what resources do we have to sort of leverage when we're looking at bringing in partnerships and third-party groups? What sort of resources do we have to sort of incite additional partnerships?
That's a good question. I mean, it's may not necessarily always be the department that has the incentive. So that's something to look at. It may be beyond, you know, our focus was really on how do we locate along the state, you know, address the infrastructure to support EVs along the state highway system. You know, there are toolboxes that other places have that you could look at, but I'd have to go back. It wasn't sort of the focus that we had there on this study, but certainly something we could look into.
And just, you know, my last question deals with, I mean, you know, you've made sort of a presentation, great presentation, but, you know, are there any recommendations or things that you would like to see that the legislature do? Any ideas of legislation or options or recommendations you would like to provide us?
We didn't have any specific, the department's not making a specific legislative recommendation. We've identified a series of things that we know we can do within our own purview today, which is, you know, obviously the working with the partners, doing the education, identifying the opportunities, looking for funding that may be coming from other resources. So we have sort of that set of action items that we're working on, but we don't have a specific legislative ask.
Okay, thank you.
Representative from Boca Raton, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a lot of experience with electric vehicles. I think I just saw Mr. Sharkey walk in. I think about 25 years ago, he was responsible for bringing one into the courtyard that we were allowed to drive around. And that was the first and last time. So I'm just trying to understand, in terms of along the corridor, say I-95, the Turnpike, where there would be charging stations. Are those competitively bid charging stations? And is it the PSC that would regulate the price? So I'm kind of thinking of it in terms of gasoline, you know, who regulates the price of gas and, you know, where are they placed? It's kind of, there's an infrastructure in place for that. So are the charging stations gonna replicate something like that?
You know, that's something that we're going to have to work through because, and I'll let, on the PSC, I'll let Casey answer that because I know there's some real technical provisions about what they're allowed to regulate and whatnot, and so I don't want to dive into that. But as we look forward, one of the issues that we're going to be challenged with is that there are some limitations about what we can do on the state highway system. Now, we have some flexibility on the Turnpike. So those will be the kind of things, especially if there is a federal program to promote EV infrastructure, we're going to be looking for how those rules come out that will kind of give us some guidance in terms of how we can be putting those resources out but generally that is a real challenge for us. For example, at a rest area, we can't put an EV charging station and charge for it. So we could put one out there, but we just can't charge somebody to use it. And that's a federal limit. That's federal statute. And there's also some limits in Florida Administrative Code in terms of actually going and plugging in your car at a rest area as well. So there's some hurdles, but because these would typically be public-private partnerships, that's where we would look at different approaches to how you would procure it.
She was touching on something that was, I think we all have a general interest in, is who all is involved in the establishment of the electric infrastructure. I mean, you have, obviously, the utility companies have a vested interest. You have the state that has an interest. You're telling me that the feds are having a greater interest, private operators, automobile manufacturers. So who's ultimately responsible for making those decisions on where we're going to add capacity, whether it's on the interstate or whether it's, you know, in the rural communities? Are the federal, is the federal government, are they giving us a lot of free will? Or do we have, you know where I'm going with this.
Yeah. Go ahead. We don't know yet in terms of any federal program, because there'll be rules and ANOFA and those kind of things that will come out that will give us the guidelines. But in large part, it's the market, but then it's how do we figure out how to work with partners where the market's not going, that's also causing becoming a barrier for people to feel comfortable about actually being able to get out on the road. So it is, you kind of named all the partners. I mean, that's what it is. And at the end of the day, the challenge for us is to figure out, you know, what's the right place, and what's the public purpose and benefit of working to fill those gaps, and how do you accomplish that?
So I think I would have been comparing it to what a gas station looks like. So if I wanted to, like my grandfather, he owned a gas station at one time. So he bought the land and, you know, got the permits, and he was able to buy from a jobber and sell gas. It sounds like this is not that easy. So let's just say if Representative LaMarca wanted to buy a charging, he wanted to become a charging station operator, can he do that? Or is this something that primarily the manufacturers are looking at, or maybe the power companies are responsible for? Like, if he were to want to venture off into that type of investment, where would he start?
So,
Does it not work that way?
There are third party providers out there. I mean, there's different mechanisms. You're kind of getting into a place where I think that maybe Casey's a little bit better equipped to address, because it gets into that utility regulatory environment and actually which is very complex and has some challenges related to EVs.
Representative from Fort Pierce, question. Representative from West Palm Beach.
So I'll make a comment first, and then I'll ask the question. There's a lot of different ways, obviously, to do incentives. One of the ways we all think about is good environmentalists, that we want to incentivize more people to drive electric vehicles. To me, I think about it as like there's employer incentives. Like, I want people that work for me to drive electric cars, so I'm going to put a charging station in my garage, and my employees are driving, on average, 25 miles to work every day, and I can encourage more people to drive cars, and that's something the employer decides to do. Before I get any further, I do want to ask a question that came up, if I might, Chair. Are you telling me that in a rest area you can put a charging station, but you're not allowed to charge for the electricity? Is that what you said?
There's limits in federal law related to concessions at rest areas. Now, we do put in vending machines, but we do that in coordination with blind services, and they receive the revenue. So that's like the kind of one you'll see you don't see, except on the turnpike, concessions at rest areas, and this would be a concession.
So if you come and buy candy, we'll give you electricity? I don't understand what you're saying. Okay, to continue, so not to take too much time, Chair, thank you. So,
no, I was informed we have until noon, so take all the time you want up till noon.
Sir, don't encourage me, sorry. So the good news is there's also something that I want to ask a question about. It's called knowledge incentives. I think it really would be helpful, and I think it's hard to ask the Department of Transportation, because I feel like you're working against yourself. You're decreasing the amount of fuel gas taxes you're getting by encouraging electricity, but I think the public would really benefit from having a better understanding. As we, as the chair mentioned, things like the cost of energy, you know, electricity is cheaper than fuel, because a component of fuel cost is you got to carry it around with you. Electricity is generated a different way, so the cost of electricity, because it's mass produced in the state of Florida, is cheaper, I think, per energy component than fuel. So that's the kind of information I think people need. How do we, how can we, as the Florida legislature or the DOT or who, how can we get more information? We really need information as to why it makes economic sense for people to drive electric vehicles. So, who does that?
I think that's something that's when I talked about our implementation and talked about education and our partnerships. We have the existing EVSC working group that we're going to continue to work with. We have folks within that group that can help, but education is a piece of it for sure. And I understand your point about kind of the declining revenue, but at the end of the day, we're about providing mobility, and so this is part of how do we provide mobility within the state.
I think Representative Roth wants FDOT to give him a model car so he can drive it around in his area and be the spokesperson. Let's see, Representative from Osprey, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Chair, and great presentation. And just to kind of continue along with the line of questioning the Chair had earlier around electric infrastructure, you were talking a little bit earlier about wireless power transfer and what that might look like. Is that currently being used in any other states? And is the technology there? And I know there's when it comes to charging stations, depending on the brand, Tesla has their own. There's a couple different types of charging stations. Are all these different electric vehicles equipped and retrofitted where they could charge in a wireless type setting using the same infrastructure or using the same kind of charging mechanism, I suppose?
Can the battery actually...
Correct.
Take the charge from an inductive. That is an issue. And actually, it's an issue that we're dealing with when we move from level one, two to three, because a plug-in hybrid electric and many battery electric vehicles that are using level two charging can't use level three charging. So that is a challenge. In terms of use, you'll see the inductive charging used in the transit industry. Sometimes you'll see those, the overhead inductive charging, but they do have charging under the bus too. So they actually, some of the electric buses do use inductive charging. And I know that like the streetcar in Bordeaux is an inductive charging. It's been that way for a while. So it's not entirely new, but the technology's really been developing more rapidly of late.
And just one follow-up, Mr. Chair. Is the idea inductive charging could be done across brand as well? So, for instance, I mentioned earlier Tesla has their own charging stations. Hypothetically, the same type of technology could be used to charge a Tesla versus a Ford or another brand?
Ideally.
Okay. Yeah. And, Mr. Chair, one more question.
Sure. You're recognized.
Thank you. And as it relates to kind of the methodology around what is the appropriate number of charging stations, going back to what we were talking earlier, I know Representative Fine was talking a little bit about queuing within the stations, and I've seen that as well. I'm not currently driving an electric vehicle, but I have seen it at some of these locations. But I'm talking specifically more about how are we arriving at what the appropriate number should look like over time? And I know you talked a little bit about it, but I don't think you maybe specifically addressed that.
I think we would be, we do provide in the report some goals in terms of, that spacing and then the numbers, like you would have, at least two every 25 miles, and then it would go to six and then it would go to eight. But the reality is it's going to, at the end of the day, be driven by the market. and then our assessment of what the need is in an emergency evacuation, depending on the level of adoption. So it's a moving target, really.
Thank you.
Representative from Port St. Joe, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to ask if DOT has done any type of study into the impact the state will face 10 years, 20 years down the road on the batteries that these cars are using and where we're going to be disposing of them. Are other states looking at that and adding that into the cost up front, or is that a private sector issue entirely?
I would probably have to defer to DEP on that, and we can ask them if they, what they've looked at in that regard. I don't know that we actually did that as part of this study, though.
That's a good question, though. Let's see. Representative from Jacksonville, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair. I appreciate you. Good morning. Thank you for the presentation. You've mentioned emergency evacuation a couple of times. And I know reading through this plan, FEMA is mentioned to reimburse electricity associated with electric vehicles during an emergency. Is that some type of legislative framework that other states have? And if so, what's the approach? And are we looking to use any of those approaches?
That was really an issue that was identified that probably needs to be further worked through with FEMA, because we are concerned that in the event of an emergency, you may have communications that go down, which is the basis for the charging. And so what do you do if that happens and we need to move people out of the state? We have to have some, we've got to think through the mechanisms and the scenarios. And part of that just is that collaboration with FEMA. It's not in place as we talked today, but that was one of the key issues we identified for further exploration.
Thank you for that. And as we're talking about this, everything is a cost. So do we have any numbers or data on the financial investment or funding from the state that would be required for this endeavor?
We don't have a recommendation in terms of funding needed. A lot of it is trying to, again, figuring strategies to bridge the gap to get the infrastructure in those areas that it's not today and looking for funding. So we're going to be developing, we've got the actual, we've got the map, and then it's a really a function of working with the various partners to figure out how do you get that. We didn't put a number out there that said if we spend X dollars on this, we're going to address this issue.
Any additional questions? Representative Fine, do you have another one maybe?
I just wanted to give a perspective so folks understand how this works today, because there's questions about it. So I mentioned there's five places to charge in between my house and here. They're generally in like shopping centers. So the chair talked about his family owning a gas station. The largest growth in Tesla supercharging locations are at Wawa's now. So that's where you go. And the incentive, I would assume, I don't know the deals, but the incentive is, hey, if I put in a supercharger at my Wawa or the shopping center in Ocala where I charge, or a shopping center in West Melbourne where I charge, or a shopping center out Thomasville Road in Tallahassee, is it's going to take me an hour. Maybe I'll go get something to eat, or I'll go buy a pair of shoes or whatever it is. And I've actually done both of these things. So I know all the restaurants at these charging stations in between here very well. So they're not the nicest shoes, but anyway, that's how it works. So they're not on the interstate. The only one that's on the interstate is the one at the Turnpike, which is where Governor DeSantis announced this. We announced it last year, the one Turkey Lake in Orlando. But that's how it's working, and it's working. You just get off the interstate, you drive a minute to a place, and that's how you charge your car. That's how it works.
Gotcha. Representative from Sarasota, did you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, could you directionally tell us sort of the breakdown between public charging stations that are on state roads versus county roads? I don't need a number, just directionally.
Yeah, I can get back to you on that one. I'd have to look at, I don't want to throw something out there.
Sounds like you do have a homework assignment.
I do. Yeah, that's good.
Okay. Mr. Thoburn, thank you. Any other questions? Yeah. Wait. That was premature. A representative from Jacksonville, you recognize.
Thank you, Chair. But it was something I thought of as Representative Fine was talking. Because he has this personal experience, you mentioned rules. And so my question would be, as far as, because I don't know anything about electric vehicles, the charging rate at these stations. And that's something I'm sure he's experiencing now. But who would be responsible for setting these rules for the EV rates?
I think we're about to receive a presentation on that.
Yeah. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, sir. And Secretary Tebow, thank you for being here as well. Okay. All right. Next, we have invited Casey Hinton from the Florida Public Service Commission. Mr. Hinton, we thank you for being here today, and you're certainly recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, members, for the invitation to come and speak. As my PowerPoint gets scrolled up there and as I progress through it, you'll clearly be able to tell who is actually responsible for publishing the report that you have before you, because I'm afraid PowerPoint is about as exciting as I get. The Public Service Commission was given responsibility. The legislature identified several areas of responsibility for the PSC in the development of the EV charging infrastructure master plan. And we worked in coordination with DOT on much of this, but this final area of responsibility dealing with regulatory structure is the main topic of my presentation this morning, since that's pretty securely in the PSC's wheelhouse. So since we're talking about regulatory structure, let me give you a brief overview of our current regulatory structure here in Florida. Florida is a traditionally regulated state with vertically integrated utilities that are responsible for every aspect of generation and delivery of electricity to retail customers in the state. Considered natural monopolies, these utilities are granted exclusive service territories in exchange for the responsibility, the obligation to serve every customer within that service territory. And they must submit to the regulatory authority of the Public Service Commission. Now, the Commission exercises its regulatory authority in three main areas. First, as economic regulators, the Commission sets rates for investor-owned utilities. This involves large evidentiary proceedings called rate cases, where we determine a utility's revenue requirements, conduct cost of service studies, and establish rates for different classes of customers. And IOUs are not permitted to charge a rate that is not approved by the Public Service Commission. And between rate cases, the Commission monitors earnings to make sure a utility stays within an authorized return on equity range. Now, to clarify, municipal and cooperative utilities are not subject to the PSC's rate-setting authority. So when we talk about public utilities in this context, what we're talking about is investor-owned utilities. But moving on, the Commission also investigates consumer complaints and sends out engineers into throughout the state to inspect electric facilities that have been constructed. And we also finally have oversight over the planning and development of the electric grid to ensure that the state has a sufficient and reliable supply of energy. Now, with regard to electric vehicle charging, Chapter 366 defines a public utility as an entity that supplies electricity to the public within the state. And the Commission has interpreted that to mean that you are considered a public utility if you sell electricity to a retail customer. And the Florida Supreme Court has upheld that interpretation in the PW Ventures case. So essentially, with the combination of that and exclusive service territories, third-party sales of electricity to retail customers is prohibited within the state of Florida. However, the legislature has exempted electric vehicle charging service from this prohibition. 366.94 states that EV charging by a non-utility is not considered the retail sale of electricity for the purposes of 366, and therefore is not subject to the regulation of the Public Service Commission. That section also places the EV stations themselves, EV charging stations themselves, under the regulatory authority of the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, just like all other fueling stations. To prepare our contribution to the EV Master Plan, the Commission staff issued a request for comment regarding statutory structure and public utility involvement in the charging marketplace. We received 15 sets of comments from utilities, EV charging companies, environmental organizations, and other stakeholders. And then we followed that up with a workshop where we discussed the topics raised by commenters, and then followed that up with another round of post-workshop comment. And through this process, we discovered that there is a general consensus that no changes to the current regulatory structure are necessary to facilitate the deployment of charging infrastructure. Commenters believe that we should maintain a focus on flexibility in order to adopt different ownership models based upon site-specific circumstances, and we should discourage prematurely or narrowly defining the role of public utilities, given the nascence of the market and to need to address gaps in the charging infrastructure. So having said that, as the EV market expands and with it the charging infrastructure, the Commission will be called upon to make decisions about public utility involvement in this marketplace. In the master plan, we tried to identify some regulatory issues to be considered as public utilities bring programs to the Commission for approval. We grouped them into two areas. First, utility interaction with third-party chargers that already exist or will come into the market, and also the utilities participating directly in the market as providing charging services. So with regard to how utilities interact with third-party charges, we addressed a couple different topics: make-ready installations and the rates that are to be charged these third-party chargers. Now, make-ready installation refers to when the utility installs all the electric infrastructure necessary to run a EV charging station. Then the third-party owner will then come in and install the actual the charging port itself. And so you have, that's basically the meter where one has responsibility and the other doesn't. Under traditional cost of service regulation, there's this idea of the party causing costs to be incurred should be responsible for bearing those costs, not the general body of ratepayers. So under this approach, the cost of make-ready installations should be recovered from that third-party charging company. So if the charging station fails or for otherwise the utility is unable to recover the costs of that make-ready installation, that make-ready installation could result in what we call stranded costs that could then be passed on to the general body of ratepayers, which is something, as I stated, we generally try to avoid. However, public policymakers seeking to encourage the deployment of this infrastructure could determine that alternative cost recovery is appropriate, as has happened in the past with nuclear construction costs and most recently storm protection plan costs, where alternative cost recovery mechanisms were established. With regard to rates and rate design, this is another regulatory consideration that was brought to our attention. For example, stakeholders communicated that demand charges may serve as an impediment to the installation of DC fast charging stations. Now, commercial and industrial customers, which a DC fast charging would fall into that category, they're generally charged an energy charge that's based upon kilowatt hour usage, but also a demand charge, which is intended to recover the cost of facilities that must be built and maintained to provide that customer's peak demand, no matter how often that peak demand is actually reached. The utility has to be prepared to make it, to meet it. Then demand charges could challenge the economics of a DC fast charger that has a high peak but low volume of energy sales. So in this situation, peak demand at an infrequently used site could be established by a single customer charging his car rather than the aggregate of a bunch of customers charging their vehicles at the busiest time. And this could result in the demand charge being spread over fewer energy customers, and fewer A low volume of energy sales making it more difficult for the station owner to recover their costs and still charge a competitive rate at that charging station. So in addition to considering whether demand charges are appropriate for EV charging, utilities may also consider how rate structure could be used to help manage the new demand created by vehicle charging. And time of use rates based upon the cost of producing energy at different times of the day can be a mechanism for encouraging EV charging during off-peak times. Now, with regard to utility participation, we looked at two different areas where competitive neutrality and generally in the cost of service. With regard to competitive neutrality, what we're getting at is there are currently participants in the EV charging marketplace that face private capitalization and competition for high usage locations. Potentially, a utility with lower capital risk due to rate-based regulation could have an advantage in the marketplace. However, public policy priorities may determine that the advantages of rapid deployment and the ability of utilities to serve high-cost, low-usage locations may outweigh any potential competitive concerns. Through comments, stakeholders did suggest competitively neutral policies that should be considered as utilities enter the market, such as the ability of site hosts to choose the products and services and pricing that best suit their goals for providing charging services, as well as the use of equipment and software that promote interoperability among charging locations. And as mentioned earlier, utilities cannot charge a rate that is not approved by the Public Service Commission. So as the utilities begin to enter the charging marketplace, they will need to come and get approval for any EV charging specific rate. And again, under traditional regulation, rates are set based upon the cost of service. However, current conditions in this emerging market may not offer sufficient data to determine a cost-based rate at this time. So in the early stages, utilities may need to rely on some form of a market-based rate until cost of service can be determined, which brings the potential risk of not recovering the full cost of service, but also the risk of over-recovery. That gets us to our current public utility programs. Over the last few years, pretty much all of our utilities have entered into pilot programs to gather information about EV charging. And we see in these programs a mix of residential and commercial elements. There are rebates for charging station installation, and there are rates being developed both for utility-owned and non-utility or third-party charging stations. And there are summaries within the report, but let me go ahead and give you some high points so that we can better track the concerns I tried to point out with how they're being looked at through these pilot programs. Starting off back in 2017, in a rate case settlement, Duke Energy came forward and implemented what they called the Park and Plug program, where they were going to go out and own and operate and install charging stations at site host locations, and the site hosts would only have the responsibility of paying for the electricity that's used. They would have the option to either give it as an amenity to whoever came to their business or employees, or to charge a rate for that service. And they were when that was approved, they had to come back within a few years to either keep the program going, say whether they're canceling it or modify it in some way. And so this year, in their rate case settlement that was recently finished, they did agree with other parties that pilot should end, but they would implement a new permanent EV program that includes residential EV non-time of use rate. Basically what that is, a residential customer who has a Type 2 charger at his house, if they are not on a whole house time of use rate, Duke will give them a $10 credit on their bill for agreeing to charge during off-peak times. And there are also rebates for commercial industrial customers provided that the charger is behind a separate meter and that meter is under a non-demand time of use rate. And the company is also installing company-owned DC fast chargers that will be at a fast charge fee, a specific rate for that service. And from what I understand, that rate is going to be based on an average of other charging station rates throughout the state. Like I said, we don't have enough data right now to establish a cost of service rate and or a cost-based rate. So that is an attempt at establishing a market-based rate while we collect data. Also this year, Tampa Electric came in and got approval for their own pilot program. They're going to operate, own and operate 200 level 2 charging stations. They're going to be providing rebates for, of up to $5,000 for installations at businesses, multi-unit dwellings, and also public retail places. And they're going to do free installation for income-qualified persons and, I believe, government sites, government host sites. Now, Florida Power and Light, back in 2019, they started what their pilot program called EVolution, spelled Evolution, but capital EV. And what their plan was is to install 1,000 charging ports within their service territory. And the primary goal of this was to gather information about this market. They also came in and got approval of a specific tariff for this pilot program, and this contains a utility-owned public charging for EV rate, or it would be abbreviated UEV, but that's 30 cents per kilowatt hour. Again, that's a market-based rate, not a cost-based rate, but we'll be developing that in the future as more information comes in. And then they also had EV charging infrastructure riders for general service demand and general service large demand customers. And the key feature of that is for low usage customers, there is a demand limiter that would decrease the demand charge that applies to their location, which would help address that problem with a high peak, low usage location.
One second, real quick.
Sure.
Representative Lamarca for a motion.
Thank you, Chair. Make a motion to extend the meeting by 15 minutes to 12:15.
I'll show that done without objection. Go ahead.
Thank you. Currently, Florida Power and Light has a rate case that is ongoing. There is a settlement agreement with parties that is being considered. That settlement agreement would expand their EV pilot programs to include a public fast charging program, residential and commercial EV charging services programs. But because that is an ongoing that is currently being reviewed by the commission and is subject to decision in the future, I'm not going to speak any more about those particular items. But that's all I had for you. Be happy to answer any questions that you might have. We'll do my best.
Okay. Members, questions? Representative from Boca Raton for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to make sure I understand this. Thank you for your presentation. I appreciate it. So the electricity is being provided by a utility company, and then potentially Tesla or some other third-party provider is putting in the units, right? So if the third party is competing with the utility, I'm assuming the utility is going to be charging a lower rate because they're the ones that are providing the service directly, and that it's not, there's not a middleman that is then charging the customer. And then at the rate level, are the rates going to be based on how fast something the vehicle can be charged, sort of like, you know, premium versus regular unleaded? I think I'm still trying to do the analogy between gasoline and electricity. So I'm just sort of in layman's terms. What does that look like?
Walk us through this complicated web, if you will.
I'll do my best. And a lot of that is, those are questions that we're going to answer in the future as we gather information. With respect to utility rates and what rate they're going to charge, that type of thing.
That's regulated by DAX, is that my understanding?
The third-party chargers, we have no authority over the rates that they charge. So a Tesla, an EVgo, as far as I'm concerned, their rates are strictly market-based. They would compete against each other as far as rate is concerned. The utility, if they install their own charger down the street from Tesla, their rate has to be approved by the Public Service Commission. And what we would try to do is establish a rate that's based upon the cost of each kilowatt hour that's sold. And that includes the facilities that go to it, that type of thing. Right now, they're utilizing what we're referring to as a market-based rate because they're selecting a rate based upon observations they're making in the market right now. We don't know how different that rate that's currently in the pilot will be from a future cost-based rate, or if another policy decision will be made and there will be a departure from a cost-based rate. These are just issues that we're going to have to determine as more information comes in from these pilot programs. Did I come close to answering your question?
Representative from McCoy, did he touch on, or Representative from Jacksonville, did he touch on your question?
Well, the Public Service Commission, the Public Service Commission, they would fall outside of, they have been, these third-party chargers have been exempted by the legislature from this public utility designation by selling. And so they are specifically in statute exempted from our agency's jurisdiction. They are under the jurisdiction of the Florida Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services. I'm not familiar with how that what takes place in that interaction, whether rates are involved or not, or whether it's just like a gas station with, you know, the sticker that this has been inspected and it's safe. I'm just not really sure about that relationship.
And I thought that's what you said, Chairman. I do a follow up while I have that. You keep mentioning the market based rate. Do you have any idea what that is, or it's just something that's happening in the market at that time, or is that a rate that is established?
Yeah, the 30 cents per kilowatt hour rate that FPL has included in their pilot, that takes in a lot of different factors, alternative fuel types, different rates applied at other EV charging stations. There's like four or five moving pieces that I wish I would have memorized before I walked up here to answer your question. But so I don't know, I can't explain all of the components of that without sitting down and reading through some materials I have here. But like the Duke Energy rate that they're implementing for their fast chargers, their intent is, from what I understand, to just take an average of all the different rates that are out there right now. So the EVgo, the Tesla, Electrify America, whatever rates they're charging, they're going to implement an average of that while they determine what rates are appropriate for their charging services.
And one last question, and thank you for your presentation. With the PSC being a part of the planning and the development and the maintenance of this electric grid, what entity or who, I guess, in PSC is responsible for ensuring that we have this reliable energy?
Who, within my agency?
Mm-hmm.
Within the PSC?
Mm-hmm.
Well, our Division of Economic or Division of Engineering every year evaluates the utility 10-year site plan, which they're required by statute to file a 10-year site plan with the commission that lays out projected energy needs and how they're going to go about meeting those needs. And that includes prospective power plant additions, retirements, that type of thing. So we do, on an annual basis, take a look at a 10-year planning window to ensure that we have sufficient resources in place. And Florida has a pretty healthy reserve margin as well, 15 to 20% in that area, I believe. So we're staying on top of that.
Representative from Port St. Joe, did you have a question? Gotcha. Representative from Sarasota for a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you just talk a little bit more about the competitive neutrality component of your study?
And that was a difficult part because stakeholders had a lot of different motivations coming in, and there was some discussion that, well, it's too nascent to be really competitive at this point, but I'm sure there are people that are in it that are going, wait, no, we're competing out here. And so that is just something that we're going to have to be sensitive to, or we're going to have to pay attention to moving forward. And it could be, considerations could be everything from this is a competitive market, and a regulated utility shouldn't be in it unless it's through an unregulated affiliate on one extreme, and the other extreme being the most efficient way to install chargers throughout the state is have the utilities do it, and let's let them do the whole thing. You know, those are two extremes, yeah. But, you know, and you see different states will take different approaches. But competitive neutrality, that's something that we have to pay attention to because, you know, generally regulated utilities don't exist within a unregulated competitive market. So we'll just have to be mindful of that.
Representative from St. Pete Beach, you recognize.
Thank you, Chair Drake. My question is, can the public utilities companies at some point add a charge onto everybody's power bill or to build this infrastructure to help pay for the building of that infrastructure? Or do they have to limit their fees specifically to the users, like build it into the cost of service?
Right now, the approach would be build it into the cost of service. Use, you know, like I mentioned, cost, cause, or pay is a, pays is a principle that we try to operate in. And, you know, same would apply if you wanted to make a request that your overhead lines in your town be put underground, you would have to cover the differential between those. There, you know, the idea of putting a fee on everybody's bill to fund the installation of these programs, that is a policy decision that you know, with that's within the realm of possibility for policymakers to take an approach. Like I mentioned, you know, one way to incentivize a utility investment in a particular area is to create an alternative cost recovery mechanism for that investment. So back in 06, the legislature wanted to incentivize investment in new nuclear generation in the state. And so an alternative cost recovery mechanism was established to recover certain of those costs. And just recently, a storm protection plan cost recovery clause was created by the legislature to enable the storm protection plans that the utilities file every 3 years for approval with our agency. The costs of implementing those plans are now recovered through a separate cost recovery clause. So those are directions that can be taken.
Just Representative McCoy, you recognize.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. I know we've heard within his presentation, but yours as well, of the various pilot programs. Have we done some sort of analysis of all of them as it relates to sort of things that worked, didn't work, best practices to where there could be recommendations collectively based off of the various pilot programs?
Not yet. We're still really on the front end of the pilot programs, and reports are scheduled to be filed in the coming years. And so, you know, that's something that we'll look to answer hopefully within a handful of years.
Representative from West Palm Beach.
Yes, sir, Chair. Thank you. And this is a fun question. It's a little off topic, but you're the guy, I think, Mr. Hinton. I think this would be fun to have a two-minute explanation or shorter. Why Florida is the greatest state in the union, not Texas, as it relates to them having a freeze last year and not having capacity. What does the Florida regulatory system give advantage Floridians as it deals with capacity?
I'm going to do my best not to get myself in trouble. one of my bosses is sitting behind me. Our regulatory structure with vertically integrated utilities, in my personal opinion, allows the state to have a better control over the sequence of generation, transmission, distribution of electricity. And in addition to that, since the 2004-05 hurricane seasons came through with 10 named storms crisscrossing the state, the commission initiated storm hardening practices, requiring annual reports, inspection programs, hardening programs, and we had that in place for 10 years before we saw another hurricane. And then we were able to test it with Hurricane Irma a couple years ago that basically hit the entire state. And we discovered that, yes, our storm hardening practices have making a difference. Restoration times improved. You know, as long as electrons are traveling over wires over long distances, you're going to have outages. The question is, how quickly can you get power restored? And we've been working on for a decade developing a resilient system here in the state. And the legislature recently took actions to make it even more resilient with the storm protection plans that are required. So I believe that's the answer to the question, hopefully.
I'm sorry, I was looking for a little bit more that I thought the problem with Texas was they, for some reason, their regulatory structure, they were not, the utilities were not required to build in capacity and alternatives. So when you had this part go down, you didn't have backup over here. Does Florida does have that? Florida does have more capacity built into the system? That was kind of my question.
Yes, sir. We have a reserve margin, I believe, somewhere between 15 and 20%. So that you know, a power plant goes down, we have the capacity to replace that in real time.
Representative from Sarasota.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is back on competitive neutrality. Sorry, my response time is slow these days. I heard you say we need more time to understand which end of the spectrum we're going to land on. How much more time?
A couple years for these pilot programs really to flesh themselves out and get a better experience with rates that are being charged and whether those are the appropriate rates, how utilities are interacting with third parties. There just needs to be some more boots on the ground experience with them in the marketplace to really get a feel for what's the right balance between third party and utility involvement.
And do you believe that the pilot programs that are currently underway, those represent the range of the different options and will give us sufficient data?
No, I don't believe any of the pilots represent the extremes that I mentioned. I mentioned them as extremes. We want to stay in between those in some form or fashion, most likely.
Additional questions? You've done an outstanding job today, sir.
Thank you, sir.
We appreciate you being here. Is Matthew Alford still here? Representing Drive Electric Florida, is there anything you would like to add?
No, just thank you all very much for, I think this has been a really great conversation. You know, Drive Electric Florida and its members, before we get too far into it, we're a 501c3. We're a membership-driven organization, and so we have everybody from Florida Power and Light, Duke, and TECO on one side to Sierra Club, Environmental Defense Fund, and the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. So if it seems as if those groups don't typically belong in the same organization, that ought to tell you which direction the market is headed. So great, fantastic discussion here. I look forward to circling up with each of you offline. I think that you've all touched on quite a few of the issues that that you know the transition to an electric transportation sector is going to entail. So way too much to stand here and answer. I just wanted to take this opportunity to thank, in the most public way possible, the fantastic work of the Department of Transportation, the Public Service Commission, and the Office of Energy. Fantastic to work with. There's a lot to unpack here, right? Whether that's part of resilience and mitigation on the one hand, you know, versus, you know, keeping billions of dollars circulating in the state economy that currently go toward folks that refine and extract oil. Not very much of that's going on in the state, with a couple of notable exceptions. So I look forward to working with the committee, answering some of the questions that you all have posed offline. And please, please, please do consider us an asset and a resource. These are really important questions. There are, you know, federal dollars for partnerships that are going to be coming online. Fingers crossed if they can ever get that worked out up there. You know, in terms of what the regulatory structure looks like, these are all questions that are going to take a concerted effort. And the legislature is certainly going to play a role in implementing the planning document that's in front of you, right? The government puts out a lot of planning documents. Few of them are going to be more important to implement in a strategic, holistic, and well-considered way than the one that's been discussed today. So thank you all very much, and I look forward to working with you.
Thank you, Mr. Alford. And representing Tesla, we have Jeffrey Sharkey that was here. I think he had to leave. But members, we've had an excellent discussion today. I think that concludes our agenda. I want to thank both of our speakers for being here. If there are no other matters to come before the committee, Vice Chair LaMarca moves we rise. Let's show that done without objection.